This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Our next talk is on sexual health for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We have Robin Wilson Beatty here is a speaker, writer, and advocate for disability and sexuality. She was one of the first people to talk about disability, sexuality, and marketing to adult product retailers and manufacturers. She combines years of personal experience with medically sound research to provide a unique perspective on how disability, life, and identity impact one's sexual and reproductive health and expression. She was the 2024 Carrie Buck Distinguished Fellow of the Lurie Institute for Disability Policy at Brandeis University. And her speaking engagements include multiple keynotes, panels, workshops, webinars, including the Executive Office of the Vice President of the United States and the Adult Video News Convention in Las Vegas for three consecutive years. As a disability peer researcher, she's co-authored a paper published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Congratulations on that. Welcome, Rob.
Good afternoon, and thank you for being here. I want to start out with a simple truth. People with intellectual and developmental disabilities, people with IDD, are sexual beings. This sentence should not be controversial and it should not be radical, but yet in healthcare settings across this country, it still is. Hi, I'm Robin Wilson Beatty, and I have no affiliations to disclose. I'm a multiply disabled parent via birth and adoption, and I am a disability sexual and reproductive health educator. So, and this is a photo from Sins Invalid and Leroy Jones, who is one of the co-authors of the Disability Justice Framework, which I will be talking about a little bit later. But today, you know, I'm talking about sexual health education for people with IDD, not as a niche issue and not as an ethical complication and not as a risk management problem, but as a fundamental matter of health equity, bodily autonomy, and clinical responsibility. So this talk is for healthcare practitioners, physicians, nurses, behavioral health providers, allied health professionals, and medical students. My goal is not to overwhelm you with statistics, though we will touch on some realities, but to equip you with a framework, some language, and practices that you can bring directly into your work. Because the truth is this, you're already treating people with IDD, and the question is whether you're supporting their sexual health or unintentionally denying it. So let's start with the landscape. You're already treating people with IDD, and people with intellectual and developmental disabilities experience higher rates of sexual violence compared to people without disabilities, lower rates of comprehensive sex education because they're not getting that in their K-12 educational programs. Disabled people are often left out of that kind of education. Limited access to confidential reproductive health care and greater medical gatekeeping around contraception and sterilization and widespread infantilization in healthcare settings. Silence, it creates risk. And sexual health is not optional care. Avoidance equals harm. So at the same time, people with just at the same time, disabled people are often perceived through two harmful lenses when it comes to sexual health care. That there's the asexual and childlike, like, oh, they don't need to know about sex. Or you get two, where, ooh, hypersexual and risky. They can't control themselves. And both of these ideals are rooted in ableism, and both shape clinical care. So what Okay, so neither narrative that I mentioned is rooted in evidence. Both are rooted in ableism. And when clinicians absorb those narratives, even unconsciously, they shape clinical care. When we assume a patient with IDD is not sexually active, we don't ask about, and when we don't ask about their sexual history, when we assume that they cannot consent, we don't just and don't discuss contraception or pleasure. When we assume that sexuality is too complicated, we avoid the conversation entirely. And silence is not neutral. You know, that silence does, it creates risk. So, what does sexual health actually mean? So, the WHO, the World Health Organization, WHO, their definition defines sexual health as a state of physical, emotional, mental, and social well-being in relation to sexuality, not merely the absence of disease. Sexual health includes consent and bodily autonomy, saying that you have the right to make decisions over whether you how you want to be touched, if you want to be touched, you know, having autonomy over your body and choice. STI prevention as and STI treatment, reproductive health choices, gender identity and sexual orientation, leisure, relationship skills, protection from violence, and access to accurate information. When we reduce sexual health for people with IDD, though, for just risk prevention, we fail to address the entire picture of what sexual health is. When your patients are navigating things like dating, online relationships, masturbation, porn exposure, LGBTQIA identities, pregnancy decisions, sexual trauma, desire, loneliness, touch deprivation, and curiosity. And if you're not touching talking about those things, and someone else is, and often on like the internet. So one of the most common concerns clinicians raise is consent. Can this patient consent to sex? Let's clarify something important. Capacity is decision specific and time specific. A person may need support understanding financial contracts, but fully understand sexual boundaries. A legal standard for sexual consent generally requires that a person understand the nature of the act, understand potential consequences, have the ability to say yes or no, or not be coerced. Your role is not to preemptively assume incapacity. Your role is to assess understanding and provide education. If a patient cannot explain what sex is, or what pregnancy is, or how to prevent STIs, this is not evidence that they should be denied sexuality. It's evidence that they were denied education. And that brings me into talking about, let's talk about the the can this patient with pardon me. Sorry, I got lost in my train of thought when I was trying to get this. So imagine being 24 years old and having your doctor ask your parent whether you're sexually active while you sit in the room. Confidentiality does matter. Yes, some patients require support persons, and yes, some have guardians, but privacy is still a right. Whenever possible, ask the patient if they would like part of the visit alone. Address questions directly to them. Use clear, concrete language. Check comprehension without condescension. And so for an example, instead of, do you understand? You should try something like, can you tell me in your own words what we just talked about? That's supportive care, not patronizing care. And talking about consent and capacity, that's a label. Oh, that was a slide that went with the thing I just talked about. So infantilization in healthcare. It shows, like I said, it shows up when you're speaking to the caregivers instead of to the patient. When you use the sing-song voice or a sing-song tone, or use a tone, that people usually reserve for children, and how they're talking. When you're avoiding discussing puberty, masturbation, or contraception, when we assume romantic desire is cute, but it's not real. Adults with IDD are adults. And so, mentioned about the confidentiality, and that yes, some patients do require the support persons, and yes, some have guardians, but privacy is still a right. So whenever possible, we need to the best and best practices are ask the patient if they'd like part of the visit alone. Address a questions directly to them. Use, that clear, plain spoken language. Check that comprehension without condescension. And check that understanding respectfully, because that confidentiality, that builds safety. So sex education is preventative care. So talking about micro education and clinical visits, such as talking about masturbation is normal and something one does can do in private. Talking about what contraception is and types of contraception, talking about how to prevent STIs and mentioning how condoms reduce and infections, maybe talking and asking about if they know how to use them. Also talking about how consent can be withdrawn and that no is a complete sentence and education equals prevention. I know some people are like, what is that on that slide? It's a very old, like I think 1940s, which is where they were showing syphilis and showing that it causes disabilities. And I just thought that was an interesting slide. So, sexual violence risk and trauma. People with IDD experience sexual violence at significantly higher rates than the general population. And many perpetrators exploit the social isolation that many people with disabilities experience in their life, communication barriers, the power imbalances, and the dependence on caregivers to navigate the activities of daily living. So clinicians, should routinely screen for abuse using accessible language. Instead of, have you experienced sexual assault? Try, has anyone touched your body in a way that you didn't like? Has anyone made you do something sexual when you didn't want to? When disclosure happens, believe them. Too often, reports are dismissed as a confusion or fantasy. Trauma-informed care is not optional. It is essential. Pop up. Okay. So part of So part of talking about contraception and sterilization and reproductive justice, you have to talk about the history. In this slide, is an artist who was in your packets and slides, in the description, I have what the slide exactly is, but the artist, he was a disabled man in the that was captured by the Nazis, and he was sterilized in a Nazi hospital, and he had a notebook of drawings that were found, and also he also passed away in by the Nazis. But his artwork was found, and here he has several drawings, and this is one of them depicting his sterilization. So the history of this is really painful. People with intellectual disabilities were forcibly sterilized under eugenics laws in the United States well into the 20th century, also 21st. Some states allowed it into the 2000s, and that history still echoes. When a patient with IDD requests contraception, ask, is this their choice? Is it caregiver driven? Is it about pregnancy prevention or menstrual suppression for caregiver convenience? Support autonomy. Also, do not assume that pregnancy is inherently inappropriate for the patient. Parenting with IDD is possible with support. What often fails is not the parent, but the lack of the community and infrastructure. And reproductive justice as a concept, it applies to disabled people too. The right to have children, the right to not have children, the right to parent safely. And this is talking about how sterilization is an older picture from the 70s, protesting, talking about the sterilization of mothers violates the UN Charter. So, LGBTQIA people with disabilities, so lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, queer, intersex, plus people with intellectual disabilities. And those identities are just as present among people with IDD as in the general population. However, queer disabled people often face even more layered dismissal. So talking about intersectionality, because intersectionality is talking about how we you can be of you can have multiply marginalized identities. For instance, as a Black disabled woman, I might get treated differently than a white disabled male, for instance, and go seeking health care for a condition. We can go on and on about evidence around that and personal experiences, but just know that your identity does impact how you get to navigate the world. And so, and disability, can intersect with other identities, such as your sexual orientation. But when it comes to IDD and queer disabled people, they face this layered dismissal on, well, they're confused. or they're just copying somebody, or they don't even understand what that means. But gender identity and sexual orientation are not too complex for people with cognitive differences to understand. So use inclusive language. Ask about pronouns. Do not assume that everyone is heterosexual. And remember, accessing affirming care can reduce depression and suicide risk. Pleasure is not a dirty word. Healthcare often avoids the word pleasure, but pleasure matters. When sexuality is framed only around risk, like don't catch an STI, don't get pregnant, are you being, abused? When the sexuality is only framed around these things, then patients internalize shame around sexuality. People with IDD may need explicit education around anatomy, learning about the body, having, and talk about lubrication and lube and, things like that and how to use it. Safe masturbation practices. Keyword safe, because trust me, people will find ways to masturbate and sometimes they're not in the safest ways. And for instance, like talking about body safe toys or something, if you're, use something that could, tear you up, yeah, that's not good. Also hygiene and talking about boundaries in relationships. That whole pleasure literacy. Providing this information does not increase sexual behavior. It increases safety and confidence. Pleasure literacy, that supports consent literacy. So here we talk about some practical clinical strategies. Normalize sexual health questions. Ask all patients, are you sexually active? Do you have any questions about sex or relationships? Do you feel safe in your relationships? Make it routine, not exceptional. Use plain language. Replace barrier protection reduces STI transmission with condoms help stop infections from spreading. Visual supports. Use diagrams. Use models. Provide written materials with simple language. And private time. Even 5 minutes alone with that patient can change everything. Document without bias. Avoid language like patient denies sexual activity. Instead, patient reports not currently sexually active. Language helps shape the perception. Also, build referral networks. Know your local disability advocacy groups. Know what is out there. For instance, one great thing here in the San Francisco Bay Area, San Francisco now has the first disability cultural center in the country. And it does all kinds of programming and events and resource and information about, people living in the disabled experience. And they're great, one of those great organizations that, but there are also other organizations, disability organizations throughout the country. There are sexual assault support centers, get to know them. Also LGBTQIA clinics and centers, accessible sex educators, such as myself. Also, there are other clinics out there that are doing this work. For instance, at UPMC, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. They have the McGee Women's Hospital. And at the McGee Women's Hospital, they have the Center for Women with Disabilities. And this is a center, and they're celebrating their 25th anniversary pretty soon. And they offer accessible care for individuals with disabilities, and it's the first in the country. And they offer gynecological and reproductive health things, and they are doing a phenomenal job. They are also, like, their practices and stuff, they are disability informed and work with people with disabilities and, helping, with advising and suggesting and things like that, and being involved in that clinic. And, and they also, but they also have consulting services to orgs, clinics, or anyone that is interested in establishing some sort of specialty clinic like this, or offering assistance, some advice and things like that around, like, things that they do and what you could do in your practice. So it's really good to have, I think it's would be really good to have a referral network to also understand disability experience. So the ethics and dignity of risk. The core principle in disability rights is the dignity of risk. People have the right to make choices, including imperfect ones. We allow non-disabled adults to have casual sex, date the wrong person, make contraceptive mistakes and oops. But when a person with an intellectual developmental disability does the same, we call it pathology. Autonomy includes the possibility of error. Your job is harm reduction, not prohibition. Harm reduction is not prohibition. So, a vision, and part of that, when talking about that dignity of risk, many clinicians were never trained in disability inclusive sexual health care. And it's okay to acknowledge that discomfort, but discomfort is not an excuse for avoidance. So, ask yourself, what assumptions am I bringing? Am I equating disability with incompetence? Am I more concerned about liability than autonomy? And clinical growth, that requires reflection. And this is a vision for what is possible for inclusive care. So imagine a healthcare system where every patient with IDD receives comprehensive sex education, where consent is taught as a life skill, where pleasure is discussed without shame, where LGBTQIA plus disabled youth are affirmed in their orientation and identity, where survivors are believed, where reproductive choices are respected, and where confidentiality is protected. That system is possible, but it requires intentional practice. That's possible. So, your role, you are not just diagnosing infections, you are shaping narratives. Every time you address the patient directly, every time you ask them about their relationships, when you provide them with accurate information in a format they can understand, when you can respect their autonomy, when you do this, you send the message that your body is yours. Your sexuality is valid. Your health matters. Sexual health for people with IDD is not a specialty issue. It's primary care. It's trauma-informed care. It's reproductive justice. It's disability rights. It's disability justice. It is ethical medicine, and it is long overdue. Thank you for all of the work that you do and your willingness to expand what care can look like. I'm grateful to be in this conversation with you. And I want to leave you with this quote from Leroy, who I showed in the beginning, from Sins Invalid. All bodies are unique and essential, and all bodies are whole. All bodies have strengths and needs that must be met. We are powerful not despite the complexity of our bodies, but because of them. We move together with no body left behind. This is disability justice. Thank you. And now for questions.
Thank you so much. That was amazing, and there's a lot to talk about. First, we have a question about any particular materials or websites that have been adapted for various needs if you're trying to refer somebody somewhere.
Yes. There are okay, so depends on what you're wanting to talk about. Like, what are you talking about? Like, for referrals for where to send a patient, where to get more information on these things, because there's a lot. And I can, in the follow-up for this, I can do a resource list easily and pull up websites and information. One, I did want to pull up like the McGee Clinic because I really think that they have done some really innovative things, like with, accessing how to communicate with patients that are, might be nonverbal or, they're very, very Nikki disability.
A resource list would be super helpful.
Yeah, I would love to make one of those, and I think I have one already made for this one.
Excellent. We can make that available to the participants here.
Yes, and I'm trying to put all these different screens. Okay, I've put in the chat. I put Mickey
Great.
in there because you can go to their site, and the doctor, I think this is director there, he's absolutely wonderful, very approachable and very enthusiastic about what the center is doing and what they're offering, and also how what they're learning and things like that. So
Great. Thank you.
other oh I must say other organizations, Brandeis University, the Lurie Institute of Disability Policy has like a whole department related to disability, reproductive and sexual health and parenting and all sorts of things related to sexuality and disability, with research and things and referrals and things like that.
Thank you. Another question we have is advice to guardians or conservators about the topic, especially when they seem to be in denial or are uncomfortable with the topic.
Okay, so there are various, I've seen, and I'll make sure I'm writing that down to make sure I include this in the list, kind of scripts for talking to caregivers, parents, talking to, because that's hard.
Yes.
And I want to fully acknowledge that. And there There are scripts for, providers to talk to caregivers, maybe how to give them resources. Also, it had like scenarios and things like that as well. So can provide that how to talk
That
to.
is super helpful because we can embrace some of these principles like autonomy and that people are sexual beings and that we want to support people and consent, but
But you
reality is sometimes a lot messier in terms of have they what if somebody has limited expressive communication, for example, and you're not really sure whether they meet the criteria for consent or not, or there's a dispute between their caregiver or the person that they're sexual with, or their clinician, maybe there are three different opinions about whether there's consent or not, and whether they need to be protected or not, and whether there's an APS case or not, and this gets very messy very quickly, especially when people may or may not have access to expressive communication or fluent expressive communication. Yeah, no, I'll
And
stop there.
also, oh no, one of the things I was going to say, I, I had talked earlier a bit about, sterilization and stuff. So Buck v. Bell, which is, the law that, is, used, it's the ruling that is used that to justify people in any kind of guardianship or institutionalization that the people that are, the conservators or the guardians or officials, they have the right to make the reproductive health decisions of the people that are in their care. So that means that if you are like disabled and you are, maybe in a group home, hospital, something where people, where you're under like guardianship or conservatorship, they have the right to decide to put you on birth control or to sterilize you or to make you have an abortion or things like that. And, that's happening now, it happens today, as more than just in not just disabled people. It also, they do it in, that also is in prisons. If you're in prison, that can happen. If you're in a mental hospital, that can happen. If you are in a migrant camp, it happens. So, as we can see. And I think one of the most infamous cases that people kind of got to know about that was there's a singer, Britney Spears, who was under legal guardianship, and she was put on birth control, and she did not want to be because she wanted to have a child, and that was taken away. That decision and autonomy was taken away from her because she was under guardianship, and that was legal. So that's something that we're continuing with still. Is that?
Yes, there are more questions in the chat, and maybe you can answer some of them offline. But this was such an important topic, and the scripts that you gave were so very helpful, and we really appreciate your being here to educate us today.
All right, thank you. Thank y'all for having me. I appreciate
Thank
getting to
you.
be here.
Thank you so very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.